tonight on Arena. Aoife Kelleher on the making of Mrs. Robinson and Peter Devlin on the Devlin's new album, All the Days. You can text us on 51551 or tweet at RTE Arena. Mary Robinson rocked the Irish political world when she became the first female president of Ireland in 1990, a role that she held for one term before taking up the position of UN High Commissioner for Human Rights and became a voice for human rights globally. She is now chair of the Elders, a group of former leaders founded by Nelson Mandela to work for peace, human rights and climate justice. As Mary Robinson turns 80, Mrs. Robinson is a featured documentary from director Aoife Kelleher, who chronicles her career and remarkable events in her life. Her battles for justice over more than 50 years, from the streets to the courts, the ballot box and the corridors of power. It opens in cinemas this weekend and the director Aoife Kelleher joins me now. You're very welcome, Aoife.
Thank you very much, Kay.
So how did it come about? Did somebody approach you about doing a documentary on Mary Robinson?
So in 2019, the producer Cormac Hargaden from Loose Horse approached me about the idea of pitching to Mary Robinson. So, and I thought the idea was really appealing. I mean, you know, looking back to that presidential campaign and her ultimate election, it was a really significant moment. I mean, I was in primary school at the time, and it was this, there was this sense that political life had opened out in a very meaningful way, even for young girls like myself. I mean, I think political life to that point had been the province of very much a certain kind of man, with some limited exceptions. And suddenly, you know, there was this sense that, you know, a lot of opportunities that hadn't been accessible to people had really opened up.
Right. So then you had to approach Mary Robinson, and she is pretty known to be pretty reticent when it comes to talking about herself.
Yeah, I mean, you know, she's very...
Not her beliefs, but, you know, let's say doing a full... You wanted to do a full, both the personal and the public, Mary Robinson.
She's very much on the record as saying that she didn't actually want to do the documentary, but she was convinced by her very close friend, her right-hand woman, her kind of chief advisor, Bride Rosny. And Bride basically... told her that you know, there was a possibility that something like this could be really inspirational for young women at a time where I know that Mary herself feels that it's very difficult for young women entering political life now, that, you know, social media has opened up this arena of very personal attacks, you know, and threats as well. So she felt that if there was a way that the documentary could inspire young people in general to enter public life and to convince them of the significance and kind of vital importance of it at a time like this, well, then the endeavour would be worthwhile.
Right. But was there a lot to negotiate beyond then about the areas you wanted to go into, for example, and how open was she about those?
I mean, we put our pitch forward and it was basically a warts and all examination of her life and times and career. And, you know, we were very much forthcoming from the off about the fact that we'd be covering issues like, you know, the fact that she hadn't seen out her term as president, you know, her involvement in the saga of Princess Latifah Al Maktoum. So, you know, we certainly weren't concealing anything about what our approach would be. And actually, I do think that it was the possibility of, you know, discussing kind of the downs as well as the ups of her political life that she found quite appealing, you know, because I don't think we were the only company who would pitch to her, but it just seems to have been the right approach at the right time.
Right. And you didn't get a chance then, or it wasn't, you didn't have to go in and do your pitch in front of her. She just agreed. And then you started making the documentary.
Exactly. We just, you know, presented the concept and the approach and that was it.
Now, I think you start mainly with Mary Robinson now, and then we go back in time. What was the choice? Where did you come with that decision of how to begin the documentary? Because one would think you would start with maybe her becoming president of Ireland, but that's not how you start.
I think it's important to show that she's someone who's still, you know, very much an operator on the global stage now, you know, that she's still very much involved in geopolitics, that, you know, that she is, I mean, as far as she's concerned, the you know, her crusade for climate justice is really the mother of all battles. It is, it's really kind of the ultimate challenge of her life. And so, you know, opening with that and showing that, you know, she's still someone who, you know, is in a leadership position felt very important.
Right. So that was your decision. I was wondering, what did she say? You know, I'll do it if you start with my latest campaign.
No, absolutely not. She was very hands off throughout the process and, you know, including in the edit.
All right. Well, let's listen to one of the clips. This is one of the moments you've chosen to include is when she called out the US government on their human rights breaches in Guantanamo and war on terror in Afghanistan in the wake of 9/11. She was not afraid of taking the unpopular position. Let's have a listen to a clip where we hear from American human rights activists and from an interview with Newsnight's Jeremy Paxman.
She criticized the US government for locking people up without trial in Guantanamo. People were being shackled and blindfolded with no due process. So it was, in a sense, a legal void that people were being thrown into.
The overwhelming view of legal opinion is that they were combatants in an international armed conflict, and their status is defined and protected by the Geneva Conventions of 1949.
This was a concern that was shared by the human rights community in the United States, but it was pushing against the general sentiment on the part of many Americans, just do what it takes to protect me.
Earlier, I spoke to Mary Robinson, who leaves her post as UN High Commissioner for Human Rights in September. I asked her first whether she was forced to quit. You have no sense that some countries, including the United States, actually wanted to get rid of you?
I think it's inevitable in this position, if you do the job with full commitment, as I've tried to do, over time you will build up resistances. I came into this position to do a job, not to hold on to a job.
That was Kenneth Roth and Jeremy Paxman and, of course, Mary Robinson there from a clip from Mrs. Robinson, the new documentary, and the director, Aoife Kelleher, is with me. I mean, for me, like going back, not so much nostalgically, because it was tough back in the 70s, the contraceptive train. She was a young lawyer. She wasn't in the middle of these campaigns to bring contraceptives down from the north to the south as a statement of the lack of contraceptive legislation here. But she was there. She was the person they could rely on.
I mean, I think, as Nell McCafferty points out in the course of the documentary, you know, that as Nell describes it, it was the women of Ireland were up on the barricades, and really kind of fighting for justice. And down below, very kind of polite and demure, was Mary Robinson supporting them and saying, you know, we'll see you in court.
Yes, because this kind of level-headed, sober, sensible person was a very useful face for those campaigns as well that might have seemed a little, too out there for Conservative Ireland.
Yeah, I mean, you know, Mary talks about the fact that, you know, she wasn't directly involved, for example, in the contraceptive train, but she was providing legal advice to the Irish Women's Liberation Movement throughout, you know, so she was instrumental, for example, in supporting Maureen De Burka, who we spoke to in the documentary in multiple cases, and also critically then she was instrumental in ensuring that women would have the right to serve on juries, which, you know, the idea that wasn't the case in Ireland until the 1970s is really extraordinary.
And as well, gay rights, she was very involved with David Norris's on the documentary also.
That's right. Yeah. I mean, she had, you know, she represented David Norris in his cases in Ireland and also at the European Court of Human Rights. And, you know, and he talks about the fact that they had been friends from, you know, from their days in Trinity. And Mary, I know that he wrote a letter to her when he was asking her to represent him about his experience growing up gay in Ireland. And, you know, the loneliness of that and the terror of that. And she found it really, really moving. And, you know, and it convinced her that it was really vital for her to be involved.
Now, she then went on to run for the presidency. And that is some of the most exciting footage in the documentary. How was she when you started asking her about that time?
I mean, it, you know, we filmed about 12 hours of interview footage with Mary over the course of the documentary. And, you know, she there was no question that she didn't answer. You know, really nothing was off the table. I think that she's someone who's not very nostalgic, really. I think she's perpetually looking forward. I mean, you know, the fact that, you know, I would talk about the fact that I thought that there was something really valuable in the idea of looking back at how far Irish society has come and how all the progress that has been made in recent decades. But Mary was always much more interested in looking forward, you know, around climate issues, absolutely, but also about this idea of, you know, pushing forward in politics, you know, and kind of making more and more progress into the future. So, you know, she'll talk about anything, but she's not as, you know, nostalgic about certain moments in her life as you might think.
And then looking back on it again, you see that, you know, how much she did, you know, the light on the window, the this call to immigrants abroad, which is so poignant now. You'd wonder what she would be, you know, what she would be doing as a president now. Did she look back on those things as achievements, or is that an area she wants to dwell on, her achievements as president?
I mean, I think that the light in the window is something that she's still very moved by. And I think it's I think that, you know, this idea of drawing in the diaspora, making the diaspora something that, you know, that we were aware of as a nation, and also, you know, that it started to be part of the national conversation, and this idea of connecting with the Irish abroad through the symbolism of the light in the window is, I mean, I think it's something that she continues to find very moving today. I mean, it was inspired by a poem that her friend Yvan Boland had written about how, you know, about how emigrants were placed outside and forgotten. And, you know, I think it's something that she still feels quite emotional about.
So this, of course, is all leading up to her decision to leave the presidency before her time. Maybe we'll play a clip and we'll have a chat about it then. In this clip, we hear Olivia O'Leary and then from historian Diarmaid Ferriter on Mary's decision not to complete her term in order to take up the role of UN High Commissioner and her ownership of that mistake.
Mary was wrong to leave early. I think she'd have just put her foot down and said, no, I see this out right to the very end, and then I'm available.
Here she comes.
Mary, move away!
That was a great pity. I think her vanity got the better of her. She had a contract with the Irish people to be president for 7 years, and she should have remained president for 7 years.
It was a mistake. I realised that fully over the years. People felt really extraordinarily let down by the fact that I was leaving early. Little do they know that I was going into a job which was going to almost break me because it was so difficult.
Yeah, that's her decision to take up that job. And then she goes into the fact that Kofi Annan was putting pressure on her to take up the position. But she feels she should have said no.
Yeah, I mean, you know, I think the presidency as this kind of figurehead role, you know, the role of symbolism in that is really, really important, you know, whether it is the symbolism of, as we discussed, the light in the window, or the symbolism of opening up the Oris to, for example, the gay community or the unemployed or the travelling community. Well, also the symbolism of, you know, leaving early to take up a different role, I don't think was lost on people at the time. And, you know, I'm sure you remember that it was a huge cause of controversy and a source of real hurt, I think, to people at the time, because there had been this sense that, you know, it had been such a successful term of office that, you know, and that it was almost a repudiation of that to some degree to leave early.
Yes, because the documentary paints such a strong picture of the women of Ireland who rocked the world, you know, by electing Mary Robinson and then to leave, even if it was near the end of her presidency, it still left a bad taste, I think, with people.
Yeah, I mean, you know, Mary's very open about the fact that it was a mistake. I mean, I think that she talks in the documentary about the fact that it was quite a source of tension between herself and Nick and within the family. You know, I think Nick and the children wanted to have a more private life. And you know, I think the discussion was around the fact that, you know, she could pass the baton, that, you know, that she'd done this work of opening out the presidency and now, you know, someone else could move things along. You know, I think Mary was much more ambivalent, but, you know, she really wanted to, you know, to acknowledge her family's wishes. And then, you know, of course, the role with the UN was, you know, certainly somewhere in her mind as well. You know, I mean, she's very pragmatic too, talks about the idea of her, you know, herself as the family breadwinner at the time and that there were no other options.
Yes. And then, of course, it was all quite disappointing that her, you know, her role or her tenure in the UN.
Yeah, I mean, she found it very, very difficult. I mean, she talks about the fact that, you know, there was a huge amount being asked of her with kind of very limited resources, and that, you know, there was in a kind of state of perpetual conflict, but also, you know, not really feeling that she was being listened to at all. And and that it was the most, she describes it as the most difficult job she ever took on.
Now, you presumably raised the Princess Latifah of Dubai controversy. And how did she go about addressing that?
I mean, very openly. You know, she talked about, you know, how she became involved, that it was through her friendship with Princess Latifah's stepmother, Princess Haya. And you know, that she became embroiled in this through her friendship. You know, that you know, she talks about the fact that she was asked to provide proof of life, but, you know, but she's also very forthcoming about the fact that it was a mistake. I mean, I think Bride Rosny describes it as, you know, going with the heart over there, being led by the heart rather than the head.
Right. So these were friends of hers and she believed them, and she believes now that she was indeed wrong to have believed them.
That's right. Yeah.
OK, let's listen to another clip. Here Mary speaks at a press conference following her 3-day visit to Somalia. This is when she was President of Ireland. Isn't that right?
That's
yes.
Correct. Yeah.
Yes. And is overwhelmed with emotion. She reflects on her initial anger at herself for allowing the emotion to show and the realisation that there was power in it as well.
It has been a very difficult 3 days. Very, very difficult. I found that when I was there in Baidoa and in Afgoy and in Mogadishu and this morning in Mandera, that I had no difficulty in remaining calm and in not letting my emotions show. And I'm sorry that I cannot be entirely calm speaking to you, because I have such a sense of what the world must take responsibility for. All my anger and all my sadness at what I'd seen welled up, and I found that my voice was shaking, and I was furious with myself, because I was a lawyer, I was an advocate. I should be able to speak about something without losing my emotions. That was terrible.
It quickly became apparent that Mary's loss of composure had a compelling reaction throughout the world. That this wasn't good enough and more had to be done.
I decided from then on that I would do what I could to draw attention to people in distress and ignore the cameras and everything else.
That's Mary Robinson there from the documentary Mrs. Robinson, and that was her husband Nick who also gave a reaction there. I was shocked myself when I heard her dropping the an F-bomb when she was talking to Bride Rosny or quoting Bride Rosny to you.
Yeah.
I never thought she'd curse. I don't know what I thought of Mary Robinson, but I never thought she'd be, you know, effing and blinding.
I mean, so...
What's she like, in other words, Aoife?
In fairness, now, she was actually quoting someone else speaking to her there when she dropped the F-bomb. But
she
even
dropped
still,
it quite comfortably.
Yeah. She certainly brought the room to a standstill when she did that. Yeah, I mean, you know, she has, you know, she's very, you know, she's very open. And, you know, as I said, I mean, really nothing was off the table. At one point we were... in Rwanda, traveling in a motorcade, and you know we were surrounded by state security, and you know I asked her about her working relationship with Paul Kagame, so we would have been surrounded by Paul Kagame's security, really, and you know she you
it's
know
the president of Rwanda,
the president of Rwanda, yeah, you know the controversial president of Rwanda. And she, you know, she talked about this, you know, her attitude to politics and how this was, you know, it's been hugely inspired by Nelson Mandela's point that, you know, you don't make peace with your friends, you make peace with your enemies. So she has a very kind of utilitarian approach. She'll talk to anyone if it'll, you know, if it'll improve things.
Were you surprised, or did you know before, the level of access, you know, going around with Paul Kagame's entourage, and then, you know, she's taken up to the glaciers and she's here and there and everywhere and treated like, you know, an international politician, which I guess she is.
I mean,
or maybe not politician.
As a documentary director, Kate, you always want more. So, you know, there were times where she'd say that, you know, for example, that she had just been to Kyiv and met Volodymyr Zelensky. And, you know, I was devastated because obviously we would have been delighted to go with her. But absolutely, I mean, you make a very good point that actually, you know, she brought us to Rwanda. She brought us to Washington. You know, she was very open at all times. So, yeah, absolutely. You know,
she has this kind of access. Is that her as a member of the elders or a member of her own climate change organization?
Yeah, I mean, I think that she still has huge influence, you know, her own access, you know, to presidents, to, you know, to presidents and kind of statespeople past and present is extraordinary. And I think, you know, this soft influence or soft power, I suppose, that the elders have is, you know, is really significant, you know, and, you know, they bring it to bear as much as they possibly can. So, yeah, I mean, you know, she's, you know, she's center stage at COP, for example, you know, the in relation to kind of climate change and climate justice. You know, she has, you know, she still has the ear of world leaders.
Well, Aoife Kelleher, thank you so much for coming in and talking to us about your new documentary, Mrs. Robinson. And Mrs. Robinson is in cinemas from the 23rd of August. All the Days is the name of the eagerly awaited new album from the Devlins, marking the band's first full-length project in almost a decade, after their critically acclaimed album Waves. All the Days brings together the classic lineup of the brothers Colin and Peter Devlin, Guy Rickerby and Mark Murphy, with producer Rob Kerwin at the helm, featuring 11 new tracks that showcase their intricate songwriting and solid rhythms. I'm delighted to be joined in studio by Peter Devlin, but before we get to chatting, let's have a listen to the title track from the album, All the Days.
Fade into one. that you never belonged. Oh, angel of mercy, where are you now? Come down from the heavens. You're losing the crowd. I know you felt the rain.
That's All the Days, the title track from an upcoming album by the Devlins. So, Peter, when did you decide to get back into the studio again?
We have been in the studio in kind of different formats at different times, but it was really, I suppose, when lockdown happened. It was the one time in almost 10 years that one of us wasn't working on a project, on a musical project. We've all done different things, Colin's like co-writing and producing. I'd done some production here for RTE, musical director on some shows. Guy also touring musical director. Mark as a creating soundtracks for TV and film. And so we were all, you know, as independent musicians, self-employed, when a project like that comes, you got to grab it, you take it, and you got to keep working. And then when we found ourselves in the same city at the same time with free time and not traveling, we said, OK, we got to get back in the studio and make another album. And that's where it happened. That's where the genesis was.
Now, your brother Colin is the main writer.
Yes.
So did he have the 12 songs or...
Most of them, yeah. They were like we were sending sort of ideas and sketches back and forth, and then we fleshed them out in the rehearsal room before we went into the studio. And we got Rob Kerwin, the producer, in for pre-production as well. So Rob has a great musical sensibility. You know, we're kind of the same age. We grew up listening to the same music, so we have all the same reference points, and we could, you know, touch on those when we were talking about that, a kind of a feel or a sound for a specific instrument or a rhythm. And so he was quite instrumental in that as well. And then we went in and more or less played this album live as a, you know, as a four piece band. You know, we did overdub some, you know, keyboards and guitar lines and vocals, but it's the essence of it is the live performance. And that was just a great feeling to be back in the studio room again, playing
and
together.
As you say, you're working on projects here, then Colin's abroad working on stuff, as are other members of the band.
Yeah.
Did you ever fear that you mightn't get back together again?
No, we always knew that we would. And we'd always worked, you know, I'd worked in Colin's solo albums, then myself and Guy did some stuff for TV and myself and Mark as well. So we always knew that it would happen, but it's kind of, you know, the way the business goes, it's a very tough business. And if you're offered a few months work, you know, on a film or a TV show, whatever, you got to take it. And
so what was the atmosphere there? Was it like old times, or were you all a little more mature and like did yeah. all the usual, I don't know, gripes or joy come back?
It was joy, definitely joy. I mean, when we started playing first in the rehearsal room, we started playing these songs. I looked around and everybody was smiling. A lot less pressure making this record than previous records. Our label they're a great indie label in the States, in LA. And they trust us to make the music that, you know, that we know we want to make, and they have been incredibly supportive. So we didn't feel any pressure making this. It was just fun.
And what does Rob Kerwin then bring to the mix?
His ability to make a decision and kind of
would that be something force. You're not great at?
No, we're not. And when you start recording in digital, you've got the option of, you know, doing 500 guitar takes, which Colin is quite happy to do. But Rob will say, I'll give you three goes and we'll take the best of that and then we'll move on. So he was, it just made us, you know, make those decisions. And there was that having that freedom to be able to play and then knowing that someone is going to say, okay, this is the one, that's the take. But also, you know, the fact that he could make the decision and we'll move on and get it done on time.
So we before the Nuacht, we heard All the Days. What is the song about and where did it come from?
I think it's out of the lockdowns era and COVID and also the loss of our parents, Colin and I. We lost our mum and dad around that time. Mark lost his mum, and our parents were great friends. And they used to get around the piano and make a bit of noise, more than we ever would, when, you know, on a weekend night at a party. So it's kind of about that, and also, you know, becoming parents as well since, you know, the last record, and seeing the next generation. So it's about that, you know, the passing of time, the next generation coming up, and, you know, losing family and friends. But there's also optimism there, you know. It's you know, the line in the chorus is "Don't give up," you know. They, even though these things will affect you. So there's that theme is running through the album.
And is that how the band got to know each other? Your parents knew each other. It was all kind of local and
With Mark, yes. And yes. Then we met Guy just through studio. And live work, and we saw him play, and he was just brilliant, and he's like an incredibly talented player, and brings, you know, so much to the sound, and so we were lucky to find him.
So what can you tell us about the rest of the album? I'm sure it's a state secret, but you could tell us some.
Well, we're from tomorrow it's going on pre-order. We've just finished all of the artwork and the vinyl versions. We're doing white vinyl and you know, t-shirts and all of that. So it's going to be released on the 4th of October. We do some shows. We're going to the States at the end of September, do some shows over there. Then we come back in October to play Whelan's on the 24th of October. But the album is, you know, it's sonically, it's very... very much like All the Days, you know, layers, atmospherics, you know, not straying too far from what we've done before. But, you know, there are some new sounds in there as well.
Now, you've also got a video, which I haven't seen yet, but for All the Days. And that's AI generated, is it?
Yeah, so it's an amazing director called Sebastian Lopez. He's based in Buenos Aires, and we've worked with him before. And he has created this video, which is like outstanding. It's phenomenal. And looking at it, you know, the images are, the people in it are so real. I still can't believe that he didn't get actors in to play these parts. But he created this based on the lyrics and give, you know, the prompts. And Sabrina, his wife, she edited it. And it's a really powerful video that works really well with the song. So it's on our website, thedevlins.com. So have a look, check
all
it out.
All right, check it out, indeed. Now, you've had a chance at playing live.
Yes,
we just... Yeah, I mean, yeah. And not in your life,
yeah,
obviously.
Yeah. No, just recently, yeah.
But just recently, that was All Together Now.
Yes, which was fantastic because we were down there for the weekend. We did our own show on the full band electric outdoor stage on the Friday night. And then we played an acoustic and unplugged set for Radio 1 in the tent, which was an interview and an acoustic performance. So that was great. It was just another... sort of way to present the songs. We really enjoyed it. And then we had our families there with us, and my daughters now of gig going age, so they really enjoyed it. They had their own favourites to go and see. And so it was great fun.
And was it good fun being back? And so how long is it since you've been on stage?
It was just before COVID, I think, was the last time. So maybe 4 years. Yeah. 4 or 5 years. So
and was, did you do a mix of old and new?
Yeah.
Yeah, lured them in, yeah, and then give them.
Yeah, you can't play too many of the new ones, you know.
No, but they are toe tappers.
Yeah, yeah. So it was a good balance of it, and it was just great. And we saw a lot of people that, you know, have been to the shows before. So a lot of people travelled over and from the UK, and so it was a great weekend. Weather was good, and we got to see a lot of other friends who were performing that weekend. It's a great festival. You know, I was there last year, just as a spectator.
Now, you said as working musicians, people are all, you know, people have to go off and do their own gigs, but you do very interesting gigs, like loads of television shows, famous television shows.
Yeah, well, I suppose, you know, we never had any huge hit singles, or we didn't really get beyond the sort of 1500 capacity size venues like, you know, the Olympias and the Vicar Streets when we were in North America. But we had a lot of success with film and TV. And I think we got a break when Alan Ball, who wrote 6 Feet Under and American Beauty, saw us play a gig in LA in the Whiskey A Go Go on Sunset, which we'll be back playing, I think, in about 3 or 4 weeks' time. And he saw us, heard the song Waiting, and he contacted us and said, can I use this song at the end of episode one of 6 Feet Under, this new show that I'm developing for HBO? And he sent us the synopsis, and we said, yes, absolutely. And he let the song play for, you know, the best part of 2 minutes. And after that, then other people, you know, music supervisors on HBO put our music on The Sopranos, and then in different movies, Closer, Batman, you know, all of those kind of, and that was really what kept the show on the road for us for a long time.
I bet. Let's listen to Waiting.
Waiting at the station, waiting for the right moves, waiting in the basement, waiting for the right cues, waiting in a daydream, waiting in the slipstream. Still be waiting, waiting with the orphans, waiting for the bee stings. They tell me that success brings, waiting in the half light, waiting through your whole life, waiting for an idea.
That's Waiting from the 1997 album of the same name from the Devlins, and it also featured in 6 Feet Under, and I'm talking to Peter Devlin. And your last album then was 2004, so how nervous are you about this album coming out and going on tour?
I think we were probably more nervous before we started recording it, before we went into the studio, but now that we've finished, and also just judging by the reaction the first single is getting, we're less nervous, maybe a little bit more relaxed about it.
Because, and full of anticipation, I guess, because you're touring abroad as well.
So looking forward to that. But I just think that, you know, we've got a lot of great feedback from the first single, and RTÉ have been really supportive. And I know it was playlisted straight away in the first week. And just getting messages from people, you know, in the industry about the record. So we're a bit more relaxed and very happy with how it's going so far.
Well, Peter, the best of luck with the new album that's out on October the 4th, is it you said?
Yes,
October the 4th. And the Devlins will play live in Whelan's on the 24th of October, and tickets go on sale tomorrow. That's the 20th of August. Peter Devlin, thank you.
Thank you.
Last Friday, Alien Romulus opened in cinemas, giving audiences another round of face-hugging, chest-bursting horrors. The franchise, now in its ninth installment, began 45 years ago in 1979. And there has been a lot of changes since the audience first were introduced to the deadly xenomorphs. To look back on where it all began and why it has endured, we're joined in studio by Stephen Benedict. And before we talk to Stephen, here's a clip from the film. In this scene, the space tug Nostromo is returning to Earth when the ship's computer mother detects a transmission from a nearby moon. Captain Dallas, played by Tom Skerritt, tells his seven-member crew that they are obliged to investigate.
Well, some of you may have figured out we're not home yet. We're only halfway there.
What?
Mother's interrupted the course of our journey.
What?
Yeah. She's programmed to do that should certain conditions arise. They have.
Like what?
Seems she has intercepted a transmission of unknown origin. She got us up to check it out.
A transmission? Out here?
Yeah.
What kind of a transmission?
Acoustical beacon. It repeats at intervals of 12 seconds.
SOS?
I don't know.
Human?
Unknown.
So what?
We are obligated under Section
18. I hate to bring this up, but this is a commercial ship, not a rescue ship.
Right.
And it's not my contract to do this kind of duty. And what about the money? If you want to give me some money to do, I'd be happy to.
Right.
Let's go over the bonus situation. We have never
talked about the bonus situation. Sorry, can I say something?
Let's talk about the bonus situation.
There is a clause in the contract which specifically states any systematized transmission indicating a possible intelligent origin must be investigated.
I don't want to hear it.
We don't know that it's intelligent.
I want to go home and party.
Parker, will you just listen to the man?
On penalty of total forfeiture of shares.
You got that?
Yeah.
All right, we're going in.
Yeah, we're going in.
Things all seem very fine there. That was a clip from Ridley Scott's sci-fi horror Alien, which came with the famous tagline, "In space, no one can hear you scream." Stephen Benedict has been looking at Alien. So it's widely regarded, Stephen, as a lot more than just a horror film. Why is that?
I think because it is so open to interpretation. I mean, the funny thing is the film is one of the most examined films in the history of cinema. You've got 2001, Psycho, Citizen Kane, but Alien is right up there. And as I said, it's so open to interpretation. And you've got literally thousands, hundreds of thousands of PhDs, undergraduate essays, master's theses, let alone books and video essays on YouTube. And as I said, it's so open to interpretation. So you've got the feminist analysis of the film because Lieutenant Ellen Ripley is such a groundbreaking,
Sigourney Weaver character.
Yeah, self-reliant character. You've also got the Freudian analysis because a lot of the imagery alludes to sex. You've got the Marxist approach because the crew are all expendable as far as the company is concerned. You've also got body horror because the xenomorph inflicts such terrible things upon the human body. But those are all the angles, Kay. But if you don't mind, I'd like to stay away from that analysis. Because, you know,
God, I had very hard questions set for you. But go on. What angle do you want
on? Well, I'd like to explore how the film works, because the thing is that if a film doesn't work, no amount of PhD analysis will make it work. So I think one angle to explore is the xenomorph character itself and how specifically it's introduced.
Yes, because you talk about the storytelling in Alien,
yeah,
and that it, you know, that we must explore how it works. So yeah. how do they work?
Well,
how do the xenomorphs are the face huggers?
Yeah, one of the essential aspects of storytelling is anticipation, and anticipation for the audience, it makes them lean out of their chair and expect what's going to happen next. And then the thing is, when one way of building that up is to build up the introduction, the anticipation of a certain character. And if you think about the great introductions, like King Kong doesn't arrive until about an hour into the film, that's only 90 minutes. The Wicked Witch of the West and The Wizard of Oz. If you think of third man, Harry Lime. You know, these are great introductions, but the thing about a great introduction is once the character is introduced, the character then has to develop to consolidate that build-up, that mystery. And Alien works so well that the xenomorph is introduced four times, okay? The first time is when the egg erupts and attacks John Hurt. That's the first introduction. That's the first entrance. The second entrance is the facehugger. The third entrance is the chestburster. And the fourth one is when it's fully formed. It's going marauding around the ship, killing off the rest of the crew. And that is a perfect example of character development, because they literally, the xenomorph, the shape of it, is changing as the character changes. And I think that's, in Alien, it is one of the greatest examples of character introductions that we've ever seen in the history of cinema.
And also, those character introductions are introduced to the cast. Mm. But do we get inklings that there are aliens present before the cast do?
Well, I think one way that happens is through the use of music. Okay, because, and this is where it gets a little bit complicated, because originally Ridley Scott wanted to use a Japanese composer, Isao Tomita, but he had never composed a film score before. And the studio was a little bit anxious about an inexperienced composer, so they went with Jerry Goldsmith. And Jerry Goldsmith had vast experience. He'd scored over 30 pictures. He'd won an Oscar for The Omen, which is a horror film. He'd done sci-fi with Planet of the Apes and Star Trek. And the thing was that Ridley Scott then, as per usual, when they go to score a film, they use what are called temp tracks. Now, composers despise temp tracks because
what's that?
Well, a temp track is a piece of music that the archive will have, that they have in an archive, and they'll basically spot it on the film to convey what the tone of the scene should be like and what sort of music they're looking for. Composers despise them because inevitably the director falls in love with the temp track and says to the composer, "Give me that." And so to ward that off...
Yes, because, of course, the composer always wants to be intrinsic original. To the film
exactly.
as well, doesn't
exactly.
he?
You know, yeah, and that's the reason why you get Jerry Goldsmith, because he wants Jerry Goldsmith. Mm-hmm. So the thing was that in order to ward that away, what Ridley Scott and the editor Terry Rawlings did was they went back through Jerry Goldsmith's back catalogue and they started pilfering scores, melodies from different films and popped them in the movie. Now, when Jerry Goldsmith heard that, he was absolutely furious. And then when he presented his compositions, Ridley Scott didn't like them and stuck with the temp tracks. So the thing
so
is...
did they fall out?
No, they were.
There was tension.
We'll be polite about it. But the thing is, you know, if you compare and contrast what Jerry Goldsmith originally wrote and then what turns up in the film, I think it's a really, really great exercise.
Okay, so we can do that, can't we? We have a couple of the clips here from the opening credit sequence. The first one is the music that Goldsmith composed specifically for Alien.
Yes.
So that was the music that Jerry Goldsmith composed for the opening credit sequence in Alien,
yeah.
But was rejected in favour of this piece. So that was the kind of vying for the opening credits.
Yeah.
Things got even worse towards the end.
Yeah, and the thing was that the score that we heard there was, I think, much more indicative of what you expect in a science fiction film. It's much more mysterious. The original one was melodic. The real problem arose at the end because the piece of music that Ridley Scott chose wasn't even composed by Jerry Goldsmith. It was composed by an American composer called Howard Hanson back in 1930. And if we listen to that, I think we'll get an inkling as to why the film actually works.
So this is clip five, yeah. Is that?
Thank you.
So that's Howard Hanson's Symphony yes. Number 2. So why does that work and the Goldsmith didn't?
Right, I think Ridley Scott rejected what Jerry Goldsmith had done was because that piece of music there we hear is actually very, very lush and very, very warm and very romantic. And what it does is it rewards the audience for having stuck around through the horrors, and it gels us with the emotion of Lieutenant Ripley at the end of the picture. We want to be with her because that music itself is life-affirming, because Ripley has gone through this horrific event, and her sheer will to survive is now expressed through the music, because the great music always expresses what cannot be said. The thing is, if you're to go back, and you can hear it on YouTube, what Jerry Goldsmith wrote, it does quite the opposite. It returns us, it doesn't release us from the horrors, it returns us to the horrors of the picture. And so the audience would have been walking out with this really, really eerie sense that the alien is still with us and Ripley has not been victorious. So the thing is, for me, Kay, is that if a film doesn't work on an emotional level, and that's the way music operates, is that no amount of theoretical analysis, Freudian, feminist, whatever, will make any sort of picture work. And the thing is, when it comes to movie making and music in particular, the emotion always comes first. Neurological research has shown that feelings preempt thought. Sensory input always goes through the emotional centres of the brain before it reaches the frontal cortex. So my point here is, if you don't feel anything, you're not going to think anything.
So that music is going, even though you've been through the face huggers yes. and the alien jumping out of John Hurt's stomach, you do feel better or hopeful or looking forward.
It brings you into a warm embrace in the film. Goldsmith's music was very, very cold. Very, very cold.
Stephen Benedict, thank you so much for informing us about that and taking a look at 45 years of the franchise Alien. And the 9th iteration of the film Alien Romulus is in cinemas nationwide now. That's it for tonight's show. The show was researched by Paula Shields and Barbara Rose Sanwo. Ollie Hamilton was the broadcast coordinator. Mark Dwyer was on sound. And tonight's show was produced by Sinead Egan. John Creedon is next.